already.
Yeah. Are you beautiful?
Hi, I'm Vivian. How you doing?
It's a bitter cold Sunday morning in the South Bronx, and I'm meeting Vivian Vasquez Irizarry.
So we're at 986 Leggett Avenue between Beck and Fox.
We stop in front of a tall brick apartment building that has a very special meaning for her.
This is the heart of the South Bronx. We're in the Longwood District of the South Bronx. This is where I grew up for 18 years of my life.
Vivian has these really strong memories of her South Bronx neighborhood in the 1970s.
As a little girl, living on this block with lots of people on the block and knowing all my neighbors. You know, there was Louis, there was Doña Cana, Saso Chucho. I mean, I can, you know, Jeanette. We knew each other, and then we were able to, not me, I was a chicken, but my friends and my brothers and sisters would go up on the fire escape from one floor to another. We used to put a blanket on the fire escape and lay there all night. It was just so awesome. We could see the stars. You know, I have memories of, like, you know, the Jackson 5 blasting while we're all on the fire escape singing to the Jackson 5.
But not all of Vivian's memories are so idyllic.
There was a day when I was about, I don't know, I must have been about 6 years old, 7 years old. I witnessed my first fire. This whole area was a block that contained or included businesses, a laundromat, a store, grocery store, a little jewelry shop. And one day, early in the morning, I'm looking out the window with my family, and this was all in flames. And it burned for a very long time. I remember the heat, the intense heat from my window, and I remember people just being very frightened. So the rubble, the fires, you know, the destruction, the deterioration, all of that felt like it was a normal part of life for us. I say in the film, Decade of Fire, we didn't matter. I have memories of some of my girlfriends being raped. I have memories of some of my girlfriends getting killed. There are two friends of mine that got killed, that were murdered.
The way you're describing it also feels like, what's the message of a community not having enough resources, frankly being abandoned not only by police but by all of the city institutions? What's the message?
Yeah, you know, I think that when we were growing up, especially since we had such a proliferation of gangs, the thought was, oh, they are scared of us. But they weren't really scared of us. They just didn't care about us.
From NPR and Futuro Media, it's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. And today, the South Bronx, from the fires of the 1970s to a wave of gentrification today.
I grew up in the South Bronx in the 1970s, during the time of the fires. To me, it was home.
In the 1970s, the South Bronx became synonymous with urban decay. And these fires that Vivian remembers would help create a lasting negative image of the Bronx.
Houses were disappearing.
And that's why Vivian decided to co-direct a documentary about her neighborhood of the South Bronx. It's called Decade of Fire. The film looks at how the city, state, and federal governments essentially abandoned the Bronx.
The story we were told, the story the whole world was told, was that the fires were somehow our fault.
Fire was in the air. Fire was everywhere. People were angry.
Nearly a 250,000 people, mostly Puerto Rican and African American, were displaced as apartment buildings and businesses were burned to the ground.
We could see the neighborhood changing around us. Trash in the streets. Many of our landlords had sold their buildings to speculators. They chopped up the apartments, squeezing more people into smaller spaces.
The film looks at how government policies encouraged a lack of investment in the South Bronx and how this resulted in a legacy of poverty and abandonment of the neighborhood.
Commissioner O'Hagan, why the rise from 64 on? Why is the city burning?
If you bring a poor family out of the deep South with a promise of opportunity and put him in an urban center for the first time and crowd 15 to 20 people in an apartment who have never lived in this type of an environment before, crowded into living quarters that they're not familiar with. It's not surprising that you have an increase in fires.
The film reveals that while Black and Latino residents were the ones who suffered the most in the South Bronx, they were also the ones being blamed for the catastrophe. But the story behind these fires is a lot more complicated than that. It starts in the 1930s, when Black and Puerto Rican neighborhoods were classified as declining by the government. This practice, known as redlining, allowed banks and insurance companies to deny residents mortgages, loans, and insurance in all of these neighborhoods.
The new landlords wouldn't fill the boiler in the winter, even when it was freezing out. People had to use the ovens and electric heaters just to stay warm. And the old wiring in our buildings couldn't handle the new appliances. It wasn't any one thing. It was all these things that eventually led to the fires.
The housing was no longer viable for the landlord as a place to make money. You take the rent, you don't fix anything, you don't pay the taxes, and the last step is burning it. Hire a gang to burn it.
Some landlords found it to be more profitable to collect the insurance after a fire than to maintain the buildings.
In the community, we knew that landlords were burning their buildings. We just didn't know how much money they made or how they got away with it.
That is a live picture, and obviously a major fire in a large building in the South Bronx region of New York City.
On October 12, 1977, when the New York Yankees played against the Los Angeles Dodgers in the World Series at the famed Yankee Stadium in the Bronx, live television cameras captured a massive fire in the distance during the game.
That's a live shot again of that fire in the South Bronx that Keith called to your attention just a few moments ago.
My generation knew we'd been left behind, so we would have to recreate the world ourselves. That spirit became contagious.
It's the Bronx in the house.
Stay, fight, and build.
With Decade of Fire, director Vivian Vasquez Irizarry is trying to change that public image of the South Bronx and show that it was its residents who actually saved the neighborhood and rebuilt it.
I thought, I don't think I want my block to disappear. I think I had a good time growing up on that block.
I sat down with Vivian to talk about growing up in the South Bronx during those years. We also talked about the perceptions people had of her neighborhood back then and the new challenges the South Bronx faces today. Did you have a sense of how people were looking from the outside at you and creating a narrative about your community? Did you have a sense that that was happening when you were a little girl?
I remember when I was in high school, I went to Murray Bertram High School in Manhattan because I didn't want to go to any of the zone schools in the Bronx. And during my time at Bertram, there was an opportunity to be a part of a mock Congress where we all would come together in Staten Island. It was a special event. It was a weekend. My bill to be brought up to this mock Congress floor was to rebuild the South Bronx. I'll never forget it. And my teacher worked with me on it, and we talked about, like, housing, improving education, improving parks, and things like that. And when I brought it up, actually, I didn't introduce the bill. The bill was introduced by someone else on this floor, and it was located in a school in Staten Island, and there were lots of students from all over the city. And when he read the title of the bill, to rebuild the South Bronx, he looked at it and he said, oh, this is nonsense. And he threw the papers up in the air and kept walking. And that was the end of my bill. It just got killed in this mock Congress. And I thought to myself, why would he do that? And no one thought about it. So that's an indication to me that there was a perception of the South Bronx. That act alone, you know, thinking back on it, I just remember feeling really humiliated and embarrassed. But that act alone, I think, signifies that there was some kind of disregard for a place. You know, it was an indication that there is a perception out there that it wasn't worth saving, that there was something wrong with it, and that, you know, it didn't have any value.
And a lot of times people look at neighborhoods and they're like, oh, that's a bad neighborhood. And I've always said, no, actually, that's an abandoned neighborhood. Is that what it felt like?
Sure. The hospital that we went to was considered a condemned hospital. It was officially a condemned hospital. How could children receive health care in that situation? We had terrible parks. We had some teachers who cared about us. But beyond that, we really lacked an access to, you know, sort of like a possibility of the future, because we didn't have much. We had a couple of organizations here and there. You know, we were part of United Bronx Parents, and we knew that Casita Maria existed in the neighborhood, but we didn't have a infrastructure, a social infrastructure that would allow us, the kids, to be part of a softball league, to be part of a baseball league, or to be part of a basketball league. You know, we were sort of left to our own devices after school. So we played a lot in the rubble, on the streets.
It feels like what you're describing might be labeled structural racism. And when you connect this notion of structural racism, you know, institutions that, you know, just are absolutely turning away from this community, how do you think about that and the fires?
It was an epidemic, and it was just incredible. When you talk to people who grew up during that time, they say, Vivian, I remember the smell. Do you remember the smell? Oh, yeah, I remember the smell. You know, based on our research, 40 fires a day and night. I remember them during the day. My sister remembers them at night or whatever. I mean, people remember specific events. People remember, yeah, my parents would make us keep our shoes in front of the door so that in case we had to run out, you know, or 40, 50 years later, the memory is so visceral. The feeling, the smells, it's so close to us. And it was because it was very, very deep. And I felt like that in many ways we were oppressed because we were actually pushed down.
If I live in a building, I'm not gonna burn the building because I got the little shit I hustled for to be in there. I don't want it burned. My mother and father lived here since they were kids. I lived here when I was a kid. And now you're gonna tell me go move someplace else. What for? I live here.
We weren't elevated. We were pushed down as a community. And when you do that to people, you know, people are angry.
Coming up on Latino USA, we continue the conversation with Vivian Vasquez Irizarry. She's the co-director of the documentary, Decade of Fire. Stay with us. No te vayas.
This message comes from NPR sponsor, BetterHelp, the online counseling service dedicated to connecting you with a licensed counselor to help you overcome whatever stands in the way of your happiness. Fill out a questionnaire and get matched with a professional tailored to your needs. And if you aren't satisfied with your counselor, you can request a new one at any time, free of charge. Visit BetterHelp.com/Latino to get 10% off your first month. Get the help you deserve with BetterHelp.
Are you sometimes confused by the economy, befuddled by the financial system, troubled by the trade war? We are here to help. With a daily 10-minute briefing on economic news of the day, NPR's The Indicator from Planet Money. Listen now.
Hey, we're back. And we've been speaking with Vivian Vasquez Irizarry. She's co-director of the documentary Decade of Fire. And we're going to pick up our conversation now. This notion that New Yorkers not living in the Bronx would hear stories. The Puerto Ricans of the South Bronx are responsible for setting all these fires because they don't really know what they're doing in their apartments. In fact, that was absolutely not what was happening. This was targeted arson. It was strategic. It was planned.
Yeah, I've heard that before. In fact, we went to a college to present an excerpt of the film, and a professor from, I'm not going to mention the college, from a prestigious college told me, do you know why the South Bronx burned? And he told me it was because all those Puerto Ricans were cooking pork on a spit in their apartments. Here we were in sort of what I thought was this really elegant college setting. And someone who was a professor there tells me that even if, like, we didn't set the buildings on fire purposely, that we were still stupid enough to try to cook pork on a spit. You know, it's bad. And, you know, not to say that young people did not torch, but if they were offered, like our person in the film, Lorene, says, if she's offered $250 to torch a building, that's a lot of money. In today's dollars, it's like $2,000 to be offered to torch. And a lot of young people took that opportunity to make that money. But like I said, people warned the community members. There were people who came in from the outside to torch our buildings. And the idea that my grandparents and my parents would come from Puerto Rico to destroy their home, you know, it's like, it doesn't make any sense. Why would we come from wherever we came from to improve our lives so that we could burn our buildings? But interestingly enough, that was a narrative that was accepted.
You would think, because this was not 100 years ago, this was the 1970s, you would have thought that, you know, Mayor Lindsay at the time would have said, well, we've got to help here. We're going to send more fire trucks, more fire engine companies up there. We're going to open up more firehouses. And in fact, in the Decade of Fire, they started closing down firehouses. How do you explain that level of logic?
I mean, I think it's because at that time, the new sort of business approach to management was coming on the scene. And so he brought on the RAND Corporation, who came up with these computer models that would show how city government could be more efficient. Systems would run more smoothly. You could save money and sort of take the personal out of making decisions on behalf of services.
RAND Corporation was assigned to the fire department to try to reduce the cost of fire protection in the city, using RAND computer models to predict future trends. John O'Hagan, head of the fire department, started eliminating fire companies.
They are closing fire companies, mostly in poor neighborhoods with very high fire numbers, while neighborhoods that have lower fire numbers are untouched, and in many cases are gaining companies.
I think that was a mistake. You know, it's sort of like, you know that saying, the map is not the territory? He was looking at some kind of blueprint that would show efficiency, but he never really spent time thinking about those people in the community who would be impacted by that efficiency, those strategies.
When I was a college student here at Barnard up at Columbia University, during this time, right after the Decade of Fire, a movie was being made in the South Bronx called Fort Apache. And I remember hearing about the protests that were happening. In fact, pots and pans being struck to interrupt the shooting of the film.
Around this time, Fort Apache showed up, a Hollywood movie that started filming here.
Fort Apache, the Bronx. The fuse has been lit.
We were sick of seeing our community being used as a backdrop, of hearing that we set the fires, of seeing these racist stereotypes used as entertainment. We'd had enough.
So Was the making of that movie, Fort Apache, The Bronx, was that something of a moment in the community where it was like, hasta aquí nomás?
I think that there were several moments in the community. I think that when the Young Lords took over Lincoln Hospital, it was a show of strength and a force like, you guys need to build a new hospital for us. This healthcare is not acceptable. When United Bronx Parents began to organize parents to fight for more quality education, bilingual education, I think that was another kind of turning point for the community. I think that definitely Fort Apache and the fight to build Hostos Community College was also a turning point. So there were all these sort of actions that were taking place on behalf of the community. Fort Apache brought, I think, a lot of young people and older people together. There was this reaction, like, how dare you portray our community in such a way? And so people really fought. But I think you're right. I think Fort Apache was a catalyst to help young people think about the importance of how narrative is told about place and who you are.
All right, so where are we? What did
so
you want to point out?
We are here because this is an example of the upcoming, the fear, the threat of displacement. This is the symbol of what is to come in the South Bronx. They are building luxury buildings right here in the heart of the South Bronx. If you look over there, these houses were built in response to the fires. Those are low and middle income housing units. These are going to be luxury housing units. How are people going to be able to afford to live here in their neighborhood? Folks have been promised that this building, among other buildings, will be affordable housing. This is not going to be affordable housing, not for the people who live here.
The South Bronx and the Bronx in general is experiencing a lot of gentrification. So when you travel through the South Bronx now, what are you seeing? What are the stories of what's happening in the South Bronx now that we might be hearing about 50 years from now?
There are people who share the history of the fires in the South Bronx. And those people, you know, will tell me, here it is all over again, right? We're now being displaced all over again. It's happening. People see the connections. Whether or not you're in the historical camp, you remember or you don't remember, what matters is that people are worried. And then I think that sort of at the core of this for me is that, you know, we all want development. We all want our neighborhood to look nice. We all want quality services in our neighborhood. But the important thing is that people have a voice. And then let's see if we can come up with sort of like a shared consensus or understanding of what we should do together. Those models really don't exist as much. And that's the fear that people have. Like, you know, oh yeah, they're going to take over. Next thing you know, there's going to be a Starbucks and we're not going to have our, that's one of the things that people are worried about. We're not going to have our Café Bustelo. I'm not going to be able to pay my $1 for my Café Bustelo because now all of a sudden I have to pay $2.50. Or now sandwiches are going to cost $10 and, you know, I can no longer afford a sandwich for $5. So people sort of joke around about those things, but that's real because it's economic. In the South Bronx, where the median income is $25,000 a year, those economic comments come from a real worry and a real concern.
When you look at the South Bronx now, there's a next generation of Latinos and Latinas. It's Puerto Rican. It's Mexican. It's increasingly Central American. What do you see? Like, what's the next decade of the South Bronx?
I see that we need to create spaces for people to come together and have conversations about what matters to us and how we're going to work together to make those things that matter to us and our community, happen for us as a community. We all sort of have these origin roots that weave us together. We all come to this country for a better life, all of us, not just, you know, within the Latino groups, but everybody, you know, the folks who are coming in from West Africa and everybody. We sort of need to figure out what the common ground is so that we can move forward. And we need to respect the struggle that people have had to come to this country.
Vivian Vasquez Irizarry is the co-director of the documentary Decade of Fire, which premiered on PBS's Independent Lens. This episode was produced by Miguel Macias and edited by Sofia Paliza Carr, with help from Adriana Tapia. The Latino USA team includes Fernanda Camarena, Antonia Cerejido, Janice Yamoka, Maggie Freeling, and Alisa Escarce, with help from Ginny Montalvo and Joanne De Luna. Our engineers are Stephanie Lebeau and Julia Caruso. Additional engineering this week by Leah Shaw. Our production manager is Natalia Fiedelholz. Our digital editor is Amanda Alcantara. Our intern is Julia Inés Esparza. Our theme music was composed by Zenia Rubinos. If you like the music you heard on this episode, stop by latinousa.org and check out our weekly Spotify playlist. I'm your host and executive producer, Maria Hinojosa. Join us again on our next episode. And in the meantime, look for us on all of your social media. Ciao.
Latino USA is made possible in part by the New York Women's Foundation, funding women leaders that build solutions in their communities and celebrating 30 years of radical generosity. The Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide. And W.K. Kellogg Foundation, a partner with communities where children come first.
I mean, it's just that the smells of the South Bronx, of the food.
What does that smell like? Garlic?
Yeah.
It smells like pernil. It smells like mango. It smells like roasted chicken. It smells like arroz con gandules. Kind of all in one.
All in one.
It seems like you really like podcasts, but have you ever thought about making one?
Okay, so we have a guide for you, especially if you're a kid in school and want to make a podcast of your own. Check out the new podcast from NPR's Student Podcast Challenge.
Listen and share with your friends.
I'm Maria Hinojosa. Next time on Latino USA, the banning of the national sport of cockfighting in Puerto Rico and the cultural and economic repercussions.
It's the economy. It's the pride that goes into it. It's part of our culture that we've been doing this over 100 years.
That's next time on Latino USA.